Robert Olin Butler has published 18 novels, including The Star of Istanbul, The Empire of Night, Perfume River, and 6 volumes of short fiction, including A Good Scent from a Strange Mountain, which won the 1993 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. Robert has also published a volume of his lectures on the creative process, From Where You Dream. Hopefully we're going to get a chance to talk about that today. It's also fantastic. In 2013, he received the F. Scott Fitzgerald Award for Outstanding Achievement in American Literature. He has won a National Magazine Award in Fiction 4 times and has received 2 Pushcart Prizes. He's also received a Guggenheim Fellowship in Fiction and a National Endowment for the Arts Grant. His stories have appeared widely in many prestigious publications and have appeared in 4 annual editions of the Best American Short Stories and elsewhere. He teaches creative writing at Florida State University. He's been on the show with me twice before in 2013 and 2014. You can find those interviews up on our archives. And we just had a great discussion for the Miami Book Fair about this book we're talking about today. I think that'll air sometime in November. I'm going to look that up and I'll post details about that. But that conversation really delves pretty far into the book, which we will definitely do today. But we're also hopefully going to touch on a lot of craft issues today as well. Late City is the book we are talking about. It is out and available now. It is fabulous. Robert, welcome back.
Hey, I'm delighted to be here, Marie. Here in this day and age, my being at my desk and you being, 3,000 miles away, but that's all,
Isn't it great?
That's the new here. Yeah.
That's the new here. That's how we're together now. Well, so I thought we would try something new this time, and I have no idea how it'll work, but, life's an experiment these days. And you did this wonderful series of videos, probably back in 2001, called Inside Creative Writing. And right. I think there were like 17 two-hour episodes. Is that right?
That's right. 17 two-hour episodes in which I wrote, because when I got to Florida State University and the internet was budding, it was in the early flush of excitement of new things. And I was, a special endowed professor and so forth. And sort of to celebrate it, I thought I did something that I was never able to do before. And that is, for painters in the visual art, there's a wonderful film of Picasso painting a painting from scratch on a piece of glass. Hmm. And the camera's on the other side of the glass. So you see all of the whole process from empty space to a completed work of visual art, every brushstroke. And, I'd been teaching when I got to FSU in 2001, I'd been teaching already for 15 years at McNeese State University in Lake Charles, Louisiana. And I had this in my head, how we've never seen a writer do that equivalent of what Picasso did for painters. But now the internet came along and I was in a good spot where I had technical support there. And I just went into my office, got on my computer. We had a sound engineer with me and I wrote a short story and I was working on a book called Had a Good Time, which was a book of short stories based on my collection of old picture postcards. I'm kind of especially collector of the human imprint. And so I would love to go to antique malls and go through all the boxes of picture postcards. And I did not collect picture postcards for the pictures on the front. I collected them for the messages on the back. I looked for those little, those 15, 20, 30, 40 words on the back of a postcard that rich with subtext and suggesting character and situation. And so I took about, I forget how many now, 12, about a dozen or so, maybe a few more old picture postcards, my favorites out of my collection. And I wrote a book of stories. Each short story had the image of the front and the back of the card. And then I wrote the full story behind that message. That's what I did. I took one of those cards and I didn't choose. I had several cards. I think all of the several eventually became stories. But on the night of the first episode of this Inside Creative Writing, I chose one of those cards. And so it was literally from first inspiration to the final complete polished story, 34 hours, 17 sessions, 2 hours each, 34 hours later, there it was. And the folks who tuned in real time, they could watch every lousy rotten sentence go up, every wrong choice of words, everything get tweaked and this and that, and the runs of inspiration, whatever, you see everything. They're all up on YouTube. Just go Inside Creative Writing, Robert Olin Butler. The first episode of that series has had 250,000 hits. And the remarkable thing is that, you know, it's five figures pretty much all the way through to the end. So
no, invaluable. Absolutely invaluable. So then when you wrote From Where You Dream, that was several years. So that was probably a decade later. Yeah.
Yeah, I wrote it in this sense. My colleague at FSU was Janet Burraway, and she wrote the definitive book on craft and technique. And she was a fine novelist. And we became friends quickly. And she asked if she could sit in on my workshop. And I said, sure. So she did. And I teach in a unique way. It was based on my sense of the whole pedagogy. And by the way, I'm sure two appearances on your wonderful program. A lot of this is already in your archives, but I used to take the first 7 weeks of the semester and give a series of lectures. And then we did some exercises that the students did. And I critiqued those stories for the whole class in light of the things that I was teaching. And Janet was so enwrapped with that the next semester she came and taped it all, because my fingertips are fiction centric. And I don't,
right.
I basically do not write nonfiction, and I couldn't imagine writing a book on the process. So what she did is she taped all of my lectures and transcribed them.
Fantastic.
And then, wrote an introduction, and that's what From Where You Dream is. But
yeah,
now I just give that to students, and then I'm off into my workshop, which again is done like no one else. You know, workshops, traditional form of a workshop is students bring in X number of copies of a story that they have just written. The X being however many students are in the workshop. And whether it's undergraduate beginners or doctoral dissertation students, that's the mode. You bring it in, you circulate it, and then most of the talk is done by your peers. Right. Everybody gives an expression of how they responded to the story and so forth. And then, the writer in the room, the established writer in the room sits there and listens to all that and slides in and corrects a thing or two or guides a thing or two, and then gives their opinion at the end, sort of co-equal to everybody else. That's fine. There's good that can come of that. But for that to be the total mode of pedagogy appalled me. Ultimately, it is the blind leading the potentially sighted. And so we don't do that in my workshop. On top of that, the essence of narrative, and I probably should get into the essence, this should be a freestanding, and we don't have to drive people back to your archive to get the whole shtick here. But, the essence of what fiction is as an art form and what these objects are and how they work. I am a profound believer in you got to get rid of the throat clearing. Joyce talked about the epiphany of a story that occurs at the end. The story moves, or a book even, moves to a moment where some essential thing shines forth in its essence, which is what an epiphany is, a shining forth. I believe there are two epiphanies in every great work of fiction. And there is a first epiphany, which I got the cart before the horse here. I'm sorry for the cliche, but I'll tell you what that first epiphany consists of. But there is a first epiphany in every great work of fiction where we enter into the character and enter into that, that character's essence. And there is a moment that will shine forth. What that is that it goes back to Aristotle, who identifies plot, narrative, driven by characters who face obstacles. They have goals, the characters do. And they're driven by goals or objectives. And those objectives are challenged by obstacles. That's still true. And for novelists, it's still 23 centuries later. We're all doing that. And if you're writing works that have the intention of entertaining, those genres, I'm talking about the literary genre, but the other genres, those goals are established and in fact, essentially define the genre. My goal is to win that romantic partner, or my goal is to solve the crime, or my goal is to save planet Earth from alien invasion, or to prevent the king's assassination, whatever. There are countless goals for those modes of literature. But for literary fiction, I use the word, instead of goals and objectives, yearning,
right.
which implies the deepest level of human goal making. And I've come to this, by the way, since publishing From Where You Dream. It's in there, but just sort of embryonically. But I call it my unified field theory of yearning. Like Einstein's unified field theory, you know, explains the whole universe with one formula. Well, my unified field theory of yearning is this, that if you dig deep enough into the goals of the character, the main characters, or many of the characters even, but certainly the main character in literary fiction, you will find that character yearns for a self, for an identity, for a place in the universe. And why is that so? Right. Literary fiction. Literary fiction gets at what the literary, you know, romance or crimes or whatever driving the narrative. It's the essence of the human condition. It is, what the hell is this all about? You know, the yearning is for self, because that's what the yearning is at the heart of everything we do in life, you know, and the things that are the flashpoints between people, race, gender, politics, nationality, religion, wealth, whatever, all of those things. If you step back from them and you look at them, what are those things? All of those are prefabricated answers to that central great question. Who the hell am I?
Yeah.
I'm Black, I'm white, I'm male, I'm female, I'm bi, I'm Republican, I'm Democrat, I'm, you know, on and on. I'm American, whatever. And look, those things may well be a legitimate part of the self that a character finds in literature. But in literary fiction, those prefabricated identifiers are not sufficient. They're driven by something much deeper and much more complex, you know? So that first epiphany that I contend must happen, just like the Joycean at the end, the first epiphany happens very near the beginning of the story, and it is in the literary fiction, and it is the epiphany of yearning. And it's in the DNA from the get-go, in those first 500 words or so of the story. It's in the DNA, and it accumulates in our consciousness, and then there's this little aha, this little shining forth, where we fully inhabit that character. You inhabit the character on the basis of that yearning for self, and we see it happening.
So as the experience of writer versus the experience of reader, it's in those first 500 words, but I imagine it's not in your first 500 words when you sit down to write it. I imagine it's a process of discovery, and I'm kind of wondering how far in you get before you as writer understand that first epiphany. Sometimes it could take a whole book, I think.
No, I don't know. I think not. If you're talking about drafts, only if you're talking, because if it takes me longer than the first 500 words for that epiphany, that yearning to begin to find its DNA. And I'm not talking about wild declarations here, because these objects we're creating are objects of the senses, not of the mind. And that's another pitfall for young writers. They, you know, they label things, they talk about things, they think about things on the page, when in fact it's embedded in the moment-to-moment sensual experience. And so it's in the DNA of the sensual experience that we're seeing there. By the way, I mention this because in my workshops, and that's how I started off on this rant, is that in my workshops, not only am I the only person who offers criticism, all they do is bring in the first 500 words of the piece of fiction, because what I'm talking about, that epiphany of yearning, needing to have the DNA there, it is true for a, you know, 100,000 word novel, just as it is for a, you know, 2,000 word short story, or if in the opening. But you're right, it is discovered in the work. Experienced writers, I think, come to understand their creative unconscious sufficiently that a character presents themselves to you, and they present themselves out of the maelstrom, the tumult of your creative unconscious, because there are enough specifics about that character in the quality of heart and body and mind, and there's probably some sense of a context in which that character is going to be challenged, but you feel that it's the thing that makes you begin. which is you feel that character yearning. Now, yeah, it may not get onto the page right away.
Right.
And that's the point. If it doesn't get it in the first 500 words of my students, then they put it away and never look at it again. But if that character is trying to come from their unconscious, they will return to the character, but not to those. And so, yeah, I do that to myself as well.
Okay.
You're absolutely right. But no, I don't get to the whole novel, end of the novel. I mean, if I got to the whole end of the novel, just throw it away. It is a draft that never cohered. And I've got five such novels in archive boxes at the Beinecke Rare Book and Manuscript Library. You know, I've got all my archive up there, and there are five books in there that never got published, and 44 short stories as well.
Oof.
That never got published when I did not know any of this, much less able to teach it. Those novels, yeah, I got through the whole thing and never got to this.
Yeah.
Never got it.
Yeah.
But then you just put that away. And that's okay. I mean, I'm delighted to reveal to people that I wrote a million words, almost literally, of Dreck, you know, before I wrote the novel that was my first good novel, which was called The Alleys of Eden, which was published in, by the way, only about three or so, a little over 3 weeks away, on November 11th of this year, it will be the 40th anniversary of the publication day of The Alleys of Eden.
Congratulations. Yeah. 40 years. Wow.
On that very day, a guy named Anatole Breillard, I don't know if anybody knows his name anymore, but he was a brilliant and much demanding and much feared Daily New York Times book reviewer back then. And on the publication day, he wrote a rave review of The Alleys of Eden. And that was, but as I said, a million words preceded that.
Well, I was just going to ask if, so all of the books that you did not publish and the short stories you did not publish were all pre that first book. So
it was
you trying to figure all of this stuff out by trial and error then.
Yes, yes.
Because you didn't have your videos to watch.
I didn't have my videos to watch. And I always, at some point, get around to, and this might as well be the moment, paraphrasing because I can't remember the quote for a reason that will be immediately apparent, is that Graham Greene once said something to the effect of, all good novelists have bad memories. He said, what you remember comes out as journalism. What you forget goes into the compost of the imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that compost heap that must have its way, have its time. And I think I was writing too much from ideas, too much from willed literal memory. I did not know how to trust my compost heap, trust the forgotten things, trust the moment-to-moment ravishing sensual experience of my life up to that point. And at that point, I mean, 1981, I had gone to Vietnam in the U.S. Army. I had learned the Vietnamese language for a year before I went over. I spoke it fluently. I spent 5 months alone in a Army Jeep driving around the Vietnamese countryside in civilian clothes, not fooling anybody. But trying to, because I was in military intelligence, to collect intelligence from local woodcutters and police chiefs and whatever about troop movements and stuff. And then transferred into 7 months in Saigon, lived in an old Saigon hotel, and walked. My favorite thing in the world was to wander around the steamy back alleys of Saigon where nobody ever seemed to sleep. And they're an incredibly warm and generous spirited people. And they invited me into their homes and into their lives. And then I came home and I had, by the way, I'd been married and divorced. I was divorced while I was in Vietnam. And then I came back and got married and had a child. So I had a little baby child. And I was working as a newsman in New York City. And all of that was happening before I wrote my first great novel. So I had a lot of experience. And it was composting. And I do have a good, bad memory. I just didn't know. I had to trust it. I thought I had to, because I was taking notes like crazy in Vietnam and all. And so I was trying to write for my things I remembered. And it was just, you know, I did not know how to trust the inner artist. I did not know how to trust my creative imagination, the compost heap. And so finally I did that and then wrote The Alleys of Eden, which is a Vietnam novel and very much based in Saigon. And, you know, Vietnamese people of the sorts that I've had intense relationships with. And I finally accessed them in the right way.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's one thing that I always wonder about is, I mean, obviously, I don't think you could have written those books if you hadn't been in Vietnam. And by the way, we talked a lot about Vietnam in our last Miami Book Fair interview. So if you want to go deep dive into Vietnam, we did some of that there. But how much of those lived experiences you feel like a novelist has to have to either have, I don't know if the word is authority to write, or like how much has to be in that compost of lived life experience versus imagination and research and whatever else you would manufacture if you didn't live it.
Well, an authority is the question. And by the way, I've been very fortunate. I mean, if I had not spoken fluent Vietnamese, I would never have obviously been able to write Good Scent from a Strange Mountain. And if I hadn't spent my life, I was all 12 months I was over there, I had intense, close relationships with Vietnamese people. And, they became kind of extended family for me. And so that immersion there let me write. Although I didn't write that book, I did not write in the voices of Vietnamese until my, what is it, my sixth or seventh book, because that had to settle in a special way. But, and I would never would go near and couldn't write the way I write about the Vietnamese if I had not been there, and if I had not, known the language. And by the way, the Vietnamese writing community has been extraordinarily generous to me in a world in which it would be easy to go back and be critical of that of Good Scent for, but they have embraced me and understood what was there. But the capacity to do that, to project your demographics, your literal demographics, into characters who are not of that demographic, that happens, yes, by serious experience, by a deep lived experience. But once you do that, because I've written fiction with historical basis that nobody in this era has access to, and I've written in an extraordinarily wide range of characters, but not until later in my career, because I do believe that the artist's gift can be the tapping into that creative unconscious. You can tap into a kind of collective unconscious. You are tapping more deeply and deeply into, through the character, the people that you have known directly, and diving deep into their consciousness and inhabiting them and writing through them and learning from them. Because ultimately, just as those flashpoints I mentioned earlier, the prefabricated answers to the who am I, the real answer to the question of who the hell am I is, I am you, I am everyone, and everyone is me. That we share the human condition together in its beauty and in its pain and in its mystery. And ultimately, you earn in certain very limited situations, or certain situations that are unique to your own experience and your own gifts, you are able to project that universal human experience into other characters who on the surface are different from you. We've all accepted, and rightly so, that even now, great women writers have written in the in inhabiting men in their care in their books, and men have inhabited women in their books and written through those characters. That's something that we come to accept. And I think some of those other things that seem just like it's easy to feel are utterly prohibitive barriers are less a challenge than even that. And indeed, my father and mother both grew up in families where the word love was never mentioned. It was never spoken, that there was never an expression of love ever from their parents. And honestly, if you have a character for whom the word love was has the concept of love had never been a shaping part of their psyche as they grew up, it is a greater artistic challenge to write, inhabit a character for whom that is true. If you grew up where the word, where the sun never went down without your parents telling you they loved you, that's harder. That's a greater leap of imagination, it seems to me.
Well, yeah, I would to reference the book today, Late City, which is more about World War I than about Vietnam, but the experience of lived war, or the experience of, as you say, these lived late 20th century experiences that you had, all of those emotional, as you say, compost heap goes back. You can take all of that back to the early 20th century that you didn't live through. They're the same emotions. They're the same human conditions. They're the same areas of concern that you can apply to a character once you've had enough experience. I guess that's the lovely part of writing late in life, is you've just got 7 decades to draw from of great life experience. Yeah.
Absolutely.
My guest today is Robert Olin Butler. The book we are referencing is Late City. You are listening to Writers on Writing. Well, we should at least mention your wonderful book, because I think there are a lot of lessons in here that we can draw. And so just take us briefly into Late City. And there are a couple of questions, writerly craft questions, that I think we can use that for as a wonderful example. But I definitely want to give due time to that book as well and where it came from.
Yeah, well, the book begins, and most of it takes place 10 minutes after, it's 2016, and it's 10 minutes after that guy was elected.
Yep.
And the man who's 115 years old, the oldest living World War I veteran, sees that event on television. And at the moment, and 10 minutes later, he begins to die. And most of the rest of the book, all but a few thousand words at the end, most of the rest of the book takes place in basically a nanosecond, because a character that is certs they are, and the book asks you to believe it, and rightly, yeah, is God. God comes, and Sam Cunningham, the veteran, in his main self identity, he found in great part as a newsman observing the world, observing, you know, what we call the American century, 20th century. He was a major newsman in Chicago. And by the way, Late City is a term applied to some of your readers have probably forgotten this or maybe never knew it. There used to be big things made out of paper. And those things, there was no internet where we could get news around the clock. Then they had to print updates through a day, had to be printed out in the newspaper and put on the streets to be sold. Mm-hmm. The last edition of the big, big major metropolitan newspapers, their last edition that bore a given dateline, their last edition was called the Late City Edition. This is often printed, you know, hits the street at 1 or 2 in the morning. It was still bearing the previous day's dateline. So Late City is the name of the book because, in a sense, God demands the Late City Edition from Sam Cunningham, the Cunningham Examiner. And so, yeah, that's the deal. And, you know, he's led a very full life, a married son. He covers, you know, the world. I mean, there are major episodes where he covers Al Capone and he covers Huey Long. And there are a lot of things about the world. He grew up in Louisiana with an abusive father, with some of the serious moral, ethical, spiritual limitations of white maleness in the South in the early part of the 20th century.
And probably lack of love, which you were talking about. Yeah.
And a lack of overt love. Yeah. Although he is a complex character. I mean, he has his own code, even about race. He's got a kind of code about that. It's ridiculously ineffective. But his unified field theory is playing itself out in him,
mm-hmm,
in all the characters. I guess that's enough to say that's the background and the setup of the book.
Do you think, because you spent a lot of time in newspaper rooms, is this a book that you could have written without that particular experience? Do you feel like
I do write about professions that I, and by the way, the internet is an extraordinary tool. I mean, I can go to firsthand sources to understand the nitty gritty of profession.
Right.
And then I go to the internet. Whenever I go to the internet, I'm working on a book and I'm researching, I go to it in character. You know, my early training was as an actor. And so I inhabit my character. And so I do the research in character. So the this and that, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And I'm looking for mostly the things of the senses. Those things come out of the research that way. But, you know, when I got back from Vietnam, I went to New York to be a newsman. I didn't. I went to New York thinking now I knew I wanted to write novels. I thought, well, why don't I get a job in publishing? And I didn't have any experience in anything really, except theater major at Northwestern and then a playwriting major at University of Iowa. But I wanted to write fiction, I knew, having gone through those back alleys of Saigon, turned me into a novelist, potential novelist. But I ended up not getting a job in publishing, but I took a flyer on me. I'd never had a single journalism class either, but a guy who was the editor-in-chief of a newspaper, a business newspaper called Electronic News, which was a newspaper published by a publishing company called Fairchild Publications, which had a dozen business newspapers, the most famous of which was Women's Wear Daily. Hmm. And they had the highest journalistic standards. They were hard-nosed investigative newspapers, but for specialized business areas. And so I got a job doing that. I was the editor. I mean, I was a reporter. And then eventually was given fairly quickly, about 3 years later, I was given a desk and a blank check. It was in the middle of the energy crisis. And the Fairchild shifted me over and had me create a newspaper and then become the editor-in-chief of it. A business paper written for business people who were tasked with conserving, managing, and purchasing energy for businesses, institutions, facilities, whatever. Yeah. And so I worked in business journalism for more than a decade.
Well, I'm really intrigued by this method actor approach to novel writing, because I've always been intrigued by your background as an actor and what you brought to that. So let's unpack that a little bit. So you are building a character in your head who you are trying to come to get to know.
Let's adjust phraseology.
Okay.
Because building a character in my head, there's two parts of that, which are flash words for the kind of thing that I've got to teach my students to abandon.
I love this. Good.
Building suggests a kind of technology, a kind of technique. The building arts have, are the basic building things. You've got certain established ways of putting bricks together, whatever. And that's not the way it is. Whatever craft and technique you learn, and you do need to study it and learn it, but the only craft and technique that a writer has actual legitimate control of is the craft and technique that they have forgotten. They forget it in exactly the same way and put it in exactly the same place as they forget their own life experience. So I don't build the characters, and I don't build them in my head. The head, and the things that are normally associated with the head, abstraction, ideas, the will. No, you don't. The character emerges and evolves, and you inhabit the character and you live in the body and the emotions, because the emotions are entirely of the senses. And yeah, you live in their thinking mind as well. But those thoughts in fiction are never there to give you the idea, the on-the-nose idea or theme or whatever you call it of the book. They are there often, usually operating with irony, with subtext, certainly. That this character who is yearning for this and has these emotions that I've been inhabiting with them, that person should have that idea. Then it's not just the intellectual content of the idea anymore. It's the emotional subtext of why that character has that idea. So let's make that adjustment. Okay.
Okay. Yes. No, I love it. I love it. So in the process of coming to understand Sam, you know how much about him. I'm trying to think at the point when you can insert yourself into him enough that he has enough flesh, blood, and heart for you to inhabit him in such a way that when you go out to research something, you know him well enough to do it with his eyes instead of your eyes. You know what I mean?
It's a kind of method that I detail in From Where You Dream, but the quick version is, I do a thing, there is a common phenomenon that we all know about of brainstorming, okay? And now I have the same problem with brain as I do with mind. So I call it dream storming, that I do go through a process once Sam is with me, and I don't remember anymore. It's inextricable. Of course, I can't remember anyway, because I have my Graham Greene. And have I mentioned Graham Greene? So I don't know how much, I mean, a certain amount of it, at least to get started, was very clear.
Uh-huh.
But I also dreamstorm the novel for a fair length of time. And I never stopped doing it, really. But as it goes on further, the dreamstorming is more localized and just the next few scenes and that kind of thing. But initially, I will dreamstorm. Once I've got Sam, I know he's from Louisiana, and I know he's got a terrible father, and I know he's going to become a newspaper man, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I probably know that.
Okay.
And I start dreamstorming what possible scenes, what possible events, what possible challenges to his, to that deeper self that he is seeking to define. And I just let it roll. And I often do it lying down. In fact, on the way to sleep. In fact, I've got a little micro recorder that's within arm's reach. I never go to sleep anywhere without that there. So I can then, and by the way, sometimes in the next morning, I'm going, what the hell does that mean? You know?
And your wife tells you.
Yeah, right. Nobody knows. This is the, only my, yeah. But eventually I make lists of these possible scenes, and then I transfer them to cards. 6 or 8 or 10 identifying words that identify a possible scene in the book. And I do nothing to try to reconcile. I mean, this scene on this card and that scene on that card, those two scenes are basically mutually exclusive. They can't both happen, but no problem. I've got a card for each, you know, and there might be several others that can't happen because of that. And then it's at various points, I'll sit down and lay out the cards and see what the next few might be. But more than that, they get me going and they get me pointed at things and give me certain initial hints as to what might happen. But everything has got to be negotiable. Everything can change, because ultimately it's the moment-to-moment writing that yields what's next.
It sounds like a variation on write drunk, edit sober. You know, that you give yourself like a ton of room to roam around, give your brain and heart a lot of leash. And then eventually you kind of rein it in to say,
again, if you don't mind my,
I love you editing me.
A lot of those old rubrics are misleading. No, you write drunk, you know, because
I shouldn't say drunk, but you know.
Yeah, no, I know. No, but that's, no, it, yeah, I mean, I've heard that, okay? And drunk, though, the problem is that drunk represents a kind of self-induced external dream state, you know?
Right.
It works with you, but it is being influenced by something that is not innate to you and innate to your experience.
Good point.
Like you do things you never knew you could do when you're drunk, right?
Yeah.
So you write from the same place where you dream, okay? But then you revise from there too. You go in and re-inhabit the character, and revisions have to be done from the same place in you that we talk about writing from. Because in fact, the reason you have to revise is usually because you fell out of the dream.
Hmm.
That you left the dream space, that you started to will it, that your rational mind got involved, and your technique got involved in a assertively self-conscious way. And that's why it went, that's why it needs to be revised. So to think that the implication that you revise sober is that you do it in a thoughtful, kind of clear-headed way. Well, no. You go back to the same place where it should have come from to start with.
So you would take issue with like a Robert McKee story beats, or like a Save the Cat, or some of these writing books that espouse a particular structure, certain beats have to happen at certain times, all that kind of stuff.
Exactly. I would vary with them where they offer those structures for you to understand them in a thoughtful, intellectual way and to willfully invoke them to write the book. A lot of those, the better ones of those books, certainly identify the movements of books or stories that are really effective narrative. And they identify, after the fact, they identify some of the ways in which that writer's brilliant dream worked itself out in a brilliantly nuanced and orchestrated way. Mm-hmm. So those books are fine if, when you read the book, instead of feeling like you've learned some things that you get to hold on to now, and I just need to apply this uber structure to the stuff that I'm writing, and then it'll be good. What you do is you read the book and practice it a little in a classroom situation as an artificial exercise. But what your goal is, that what is effective about this is that you will forget it. That you, again, that everything you learn from those books are legitimate only after you have forgotten them. Only after whatever wisdom is there about how narratives turn out, that wisdom has become part of your compost heap. And then it will shape, without being an idea, it will just kind of naturally perhaps lead you to the sense-based moment-to-moment inspiration of your dream storming.
Right, because I think if you have watched 100,000 hours of TV and read, 800 books, you've probably internalized how a story is structured, whether you want to or not, right?
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And all the books you've ever read, they get composted to the things that thrilled you about them. They are in there too, but you can't remember them. Look, I have marked up a copy of Late City so that I have to thumb through that, every week or two to remember what it is that the book, what I did in that book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I forget my own books. I've utterly forgotten. I mean, it's true. I mean, we laugh, but it's not a joke. It's the
truth. No, it's true. I know. That's why I'm laughing. I know.
It's the literal truth. But, that's why I'm still writing good books after I've turned. I've written three of the best books I've ever written, I think, and a lot of reviewers agree with it.
I agree. Yeah.
Publisher does. Perfume River, Paris in the Dark, and Late City. I've written in the last 6 years since I turned 70.
Yep.
I'm 30 words into a new book, which I think is going to be, feels really good too. So, but I couldn't do that without having this really bad memory.
Yeah. Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
Well, and you're right. And 76 years of lived experience. And
in that forgotten place. Yes.
Right.
And but also all the wonderful books I've read and all the good teaching I've heard.
Yeah. Sure. Well, if you want to indulge me and do the reading, it would be fun to tack it on, but I don't want to take up a ton of your time. So it's totally your call.
I am delighted if you don't mind. Yeah. How about that? All right.
I mean, because we've talked all about your method acting and everything else. So to hear your voice in it, I think would be just super fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Great. Let's do it.
Okay.
This is a scene in the trenches in World War I. Sam, as a 16-year-old, he's there young. He's lied about his age. He got in. His abusive dad, one thing he was good at was killing animals. So, he taught him how to hunt. And he is now, Sam is a very skilled sniper, American sniper, in the trenches of World War I. Before America fully got in the war, they are fighting with the French, as a matter of fact. We had some units there doing that. And there's a guy named Johnny Moon who has befriended him. And Johnny is compared to, Sam has fairly recently arrived, very recently arrived. And Johnny's been there long enough, months and months, and understands the self, the identity, the way in which being part of this shapes who you are. And so there we are. Okay, you ready?
Love it. Love it.
And I am huddled on the duckboards once more. Johnny has vanished down the trench. I rise to my feet. I follow. As I move, I stoop in deference to my German sniper counterparts, perhaps waiting a few hundred yards away for heads to appear. I navigate some bits of shrapnel. Ahead are thin, selective sounds. No moaning, no wailing, just a few strands of words emerging from an afterclap of surprising silence. Sounds like quiet conversation, I pass the stirring and rising of other men who are still whole, and then things get slick underfoot, and I try not to see why. Now I find Johnny on his knees, crouched beside a French soldier lying on the trench floor. Johnny slips one arm upward beneath the man's back to lift him and angles the other beneath him so he can cup the man's head in his hand. What I know, what I see, but do not let myself fully see, is the poilu's missing leg, sheared off in a gaping smear of blood and tissue and a white bone end. The whiteness, a shockingly clean-seeming thing, an inviolably essential thing in its color, but severed into a shard as jagged as shrapnel. Johnny brings his face close to the soldier's. The dying man is looking him intently in the eyes. Johnny holds the gaze. The man says, but softly, "Maman," and again, "Maman," and then, "Je suis tombé." Johnny says just as softly, "Ça va, ça va." I don't follow. I am 17. I am as ignorant a boy as Lake Providence and my papa would have me be. I recognize the French language, but we are North Louisianans. What is south of us in our state is another country, as foreign to me as this trench. The poilu says once more, "Maman." And Johnny replies more softly still, though I hear it clearly, "Je t'aime, mon fils." And Johnny Moon bends to the dying soldier and kisses him on the forehead. He pulls back just a little, and the poilu closes his eyes. "My way, I do not understand a man kissing a man, not at all. And insofar as one prefers simply a thoughtful assessment from do not understand, it is a drastically inadequate phrase. It's the sharp snagging of my breath, the quick, nauseated blooming in my chest and throat that make up this consideration. But my averted eyes see farther along the trench, another man bends to another man, another wrecked man. I retreat to the darkness of my own dying. Like opening my eyes in the night to stop a disturbing dream. But I quickly return to France. I have at least changed the scene. It's several hours later. I am lying in a shallow, improvised trench, more trough than trench, just wide enough and deep enough to expose only head and hands and rifle at ground level. I'm part of an array of French sharpshooters in a 100-meter line flanking National Route 29. We're less than a kilometer outside Albert, waiting for the Huns' advance infantry, waiting for the further German push intended to take Albert's rail center that would cut off the French forces from the British and open the way to Paris. Highway 29 is lined with poplars that dangle with catkins, and Johnny Moon is lying barely two arms' lengths away. We have just swabbed our rifle muzzles, engaged the wind and familiarized ourselves with our telescopic view of the highway and the flat fields before us. Now, finally, we are settled in. Johnny Moon and I have had very little chance to speak since the shelling of the trench. He's had his French comrades to attend to, and I have kept my distance. I think, whatever I witnessed, this man and I are now the only two Americans in this field, and we are perhaps about to die together. And in truth, as I lie on the verge of real war, it feels as if Johnny Moon and I are the only two men in this field, in this country, in the whole fucking world. I look over to him. He senses my glance and turns his face to me. "Ready?" he says. "Yes," I say. "It's been a tough day so far," he says. "Yes." Our gaze holds for a moment, and I feel myself disconnecting from him. He suddenly seems stranger to me than the Huns down the road. I don't like the feeling. "Was he your friend?" I ask. For a flicker of a moment, Johnny doesn't understand. He didn't realize I was witness to the kiss, but he figures it out now. "I didn't know him," he says. My 17-year-old brain, trained killer though it be, is bewildered as hell. Johnny sees it. I just stare dumbly at him for the few intense moments while he works out exactly what's going on and figures out how to handle it. Then he says, "Do you understand French?" "No." He nods thoughtfully, refining his decision about how to approach this. He says, "A death blow like that can put a man in another place. He called me Mama, which is who he was seeing. He told me he fell down, told his mama. I said it was going to be all right." Johnny pauses, studies my reaction so far. My face probably hasn't changed much. He knows what's disturbing me. Johnny says, "Then he spoke to me again as his mother. I knew he was about to die. Whoever this poor bastard of a Frenchman was. So I said to him, 'I love you, my son.'" I am still a blank. "Like his mama would," Johnny says. And he looks away. I think, "And then you kissed him." And then I think of that other embrace going on down the trench. Johnny turns back to me. He says, "Look, young lieutenant, he didn't even have to take me for his mother. And it didn't have to be me that got to him first. It could have been most any other man in the trench who'd been spared for one more day from dying. And the dying man could know exactly who it was who'd taken him in his arms. It would all have gone the same way. But don't jump to conclusions about any one of us. This is about millions of men being forced to become somebody who has to dig a hole in the ground and then go down in it or jump out of it and die a ferocious, savaging death when you just want to be a farmer or a teacher or a sales clerk or a guy stoking coal on a tramp steamer. And there ain't nobody else in the world but you and the rest of the fellas in the same fix. And you have good reason to believe that's how it's going to be till you're dead. Your mama doesn't even exist anymore and never will, nor your papa, nor your girlfriend, nor your children, nor anybody else. We are all we have out here, just us men. So when it's your turn to die and you need some mothering, you need some tender something like a mother would give you, then by fucking damn, we give it to each other. Most of us know that and live by that, my innocent young boy of a lieutenant. And so will you, I bet, after you get a good taste of what's coming at you from down that road. If today is your day to die, at least maybe you'll have an American mama who can hold you when you go." And Johnny Moon turns his face away from me and looks down Highway 29. I turn my own face. I am in the dark. God says, "You back from the war already?" "Am I? Did you get a story down that trench?" "Not one for a family newspaper."
Good Lord, I'm glad we did that.
Me too. We could talk about a writer's tears. I don't know if you could hear them, yeah. But you know, this is not a thing of the will. This is not a thing of the mind that we writers do. It's a thing of something way deeper than that. You know, it's about the yearning for a self. You know, it's about your tears.
Yeah, I mean, I'm so glad we did that because it culminated kind of all the discussions we were having today about that compost of all of it and the place that you write from desire and the craving to know yourself and yearning and all of it. It was just the perfect culmination of everything we talked about. And
your actors after all that. Yeah.
I mean, I read it and you don't do the audiobook, I don't think.
No,
do you? No. Yeah. But to hear your voice in the work. Yeah. And all of our talk about method acting and everything else. I'm just so glad we did that. That was stunning. Stunning. Well, I can't wait for you to finish the next book so we can do this again. The best.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm working at it, Marie. I'm getting there.
I love it. Yeah. I love it. Yeah. Well, the book is out, and I will get the information up there on our other chat. If people, you know, haven't gotten enough of us, they can have another hour of us. And I just can't tell you how much I enjoyed this, every minute of it.
Me too, Marie. You're you are so good at what you do. You know how to get folks to. That's a special skill, and you're awfully good at it. I'm a big fan of yours.
I sure appreciate it. Let's do this again as soon as we can, huh?
Let us do that. Yeah, maybe the next book. Yeah,
I'd love it. I'm waiting. I'm over here waiting.
Take care.
All right. Take care. Thanks again. That was Robert Olin Butler. The book Late City is out and available now. That's all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next time. Thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.